nakaraang linggo, nagtipo ng mga dalubhasa sa usapin ng Pilipinas at Asia upang talakayin kung ano ang kanilang palagay sa magiging susunod na 6 na taon sa ilalim ng administrasyon ni Pangulong Rodrigo Duterte. Sa La Trobe in Asia series na pinangasiwaan ni Trevor Hogan ng La Trobe University, sinagot ni Dr. Nicole Corato ng University of Canberra kung ano sa kanyang dalubhasang palagay ang kahulugan ng susunod na 6 na taon sa pagharap kaugnay ng mahalagang issue sa Pilipinas nang tinanong na tila walang maliwanag na agenda o balak ang pamahalang Duterte.
Actually, in terms of packaging the entire agenda of the Duterte administration, you're right. Actually, one observation I have is it's not as glossy as the Aquino administration when they have this overall framework of having a social contract with the people, of making a participatory form of governance, of having clear agendas on the reproductive health bill, syntax to finance the Philippine insurance for health. But there are indications, especially when it's not just properly packaged, I suppose. There's no slogan that brings everything together in the same way that Aquino has, the Ang Matuwid, the straight path agenda. But there are clear indications. The 10-point economic agenda that the finance secretary has delivered is very much a signal of continuation rather than change, which in a sense I think is good news for investors who like the economic agenda of the Aquino administration. Explicitly, the idea is also to scale up the Davao model. So as far as ease in doing business is concerned, the Davao model, the idea is to cut red tape, to lessen transactions in government. So for example, now there is a directive that if you want to get, bad example, but this is the latest one, if you want to get a gun license, if you go to I think the police, by 11 in the morning, by 5 in the afternoon, you should have a permit. If the person in charge cannot deliver, he has to explain. That's kind of new, and I think it's fascinating that next year will be the 10th anniversary of the Anti-Red Tape Act in the Philippines, and it's the cornerstone of Duterte's governance agenda to make the delivery of services fast.
One of the characteristics of populist leaders is that they tend to have a very strong opposition that becomes hidden, that goes underground. Hence the surprise about the assassination of very good and well-loved leaders. In that context, and given that the presidential system in the Philippines is 6 years and then no re-election, what do you think, from your various perspectives, will the Philippines that's been led by Duterte for 5 years will look like in 2021?
If Duterte does what he promised, then I see a lot of dead bodies, and then I will see Manila Bay turning red. And a lot is hinged on the quality of the opposition, you're right, that will constructively engage with his administration. There have been some indications. We have some senators, for example, who have spoken up against the extrajudicial killings. We have some congressmen who are saying that they will not support the death penalty bill. So, but a lot is, again, hinged on how the opposition plays this up. But yeah, to answer your question, if he does what he promised, then yes, it will be very bloody.
I think from the point of view, although there will be the government lawyers will be very actively defending the government on each and every front. I believe that in the Philippines, we have a very active civil society and NGOs who are very, very much willing to file cases left and right. This is proven in the cases they have filed in the Supreme Court during the term of GMA before, when she declared a state of national emergency, and then when she declared also martial law in Maguindanao. So I see the repeat of these cases being filed again in the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court has demonstrated that they're willing to assert their independence. Mm-hmm. So they will defend the Constitution. So I think that kind of thing will happen very, very often in under the Duterte administration the next 5 years. So this is quite good, actually, for the Philippines, in the sense that the law will be more and more articulated. So we would know, and the government will be given guidance, the limitation, as to what is allowed under the law, and the people will be educated on what their rights are.
Ang tinig ni Attorney Lemuel Lopez, PhD candidate ng Melbourne Law School. Nang tinanong naman kung anong palagay niya sa ilalim ng saligang batas sa magiging hinaharap kaugnay ng pagpapatupad ng kampanya ng Administrasyong Duterte laban sa bawal na gamot. Si Attorney Lemuel Lopez mula University of Melbourne.
Yeah, actually the Comprehensive Dangerous Drugs Act actually have provisions on that. So the government has to implement that portion of the law. So not only does it make sure that the unlawful acts that I have listed there are suppressed, but at the same time, it has to promote like rehabilitation for drug dependence, for example, and to promote rehabilitation centers, for example.
At kung may patutupad niya ang matagumpay na kampanya nito sa Davao, sa buong Pilipinas.
Yeah, considering that he has good experience dealing with the drug problem in Davao, I foresee that he will be able to replicate this kind of approach nationwide.
Habang naitanong din ang posibilidad ng pagdeklara ng batas militar o martial law, itinangin ni Attorney Lemuel Lopez ang basihan ayon sa saligang batas.
About martial law, I don't foresee very soon that we'll have a martial law unless the basis. Remember that the 1987 Constitution is very clear about the circumstances when you can declare martial law. So unless those circumstances are present, then I don't think that it will be easy for the Duterte to prove that those circumstances are present right now.
Habang sa Kabuuan, bilang bahagi ng grupong ASEAN, tinanong naman si Professor Nick Beasley ng La Trobe University Asia kung anong nakikita niyang hinaharap para sa rehiyon at ng Pilipinas.
My question is, given that the Duterte administration is in this trajectory of reforming its domestic polities, isn't it also a way of beefing up its economy and trying to make the Philippines more competitive in its game with ASEAN itself? So, after the administration, what do you think can the Philippines come up in terms of its game in ASEAN and other international organizations or regional organizations of that?
Yeah, I guess what I meant by saying I think the ASEAN is going to be the biggest loser in the sense that I think ASEAN needs its heavy lift, its major players to do a lot of lifting, not just in terms of coming up with ideas and pushing things along, but sort of showing the others how to play the game. And I think what Duterte is likely to do in relation to ASEAN is see ASEAN in very instrumental terms. This is something that can help us and we get something out of it, or we don't. And ASEAN doesn't work well like that. ASEAN works well when everyone sees it as a sort of collective good that people contribute to, from which everyone will get something to some degree or not. So I think from the sort of ASEAN as process, ASEAN as collective endeavour, that's why I think it'll lose out. But I think you're right to emphasise that there's some developments in ASEAN, particularly if they can take at least some of the steps that they've put forward towards the economic community that was rather optimistically declared in place in 2015, which meant a plan was put in place to make it happen. But if that stuff begins to occur, then that will be clearly beneficial to the Philippines and by reducing barriers to trade and investment. The main issue for the Philippines, like a lot of Southeast Asian countries, is actually the cross-ASEAN investment trade is not particularly significant. Most of what they trade is with major powers. It's into and out of North America, Northeast Asia, whether it's China, Japan, Korea or elsewhere. So what ASEAN wants to do is promote intra-ASEAN trade, but the Philippines is one of the countries like Malaysia, and to a lesser extent Thailand, and to some degree Indonesia, that is in competition with each other for trade in and trade out. And it's that getting those marginal sort of cross-ASEAN investment and trade decisions going, but from which you could benefit. So I think you're right to say it's not all glass half empty, but I think the balance is that ASEAN as collective good will suffer.